Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 580 of the FDH Lounge. You have with you today FDH Lounge dignitaries Rick Morris and Steve Callis here to break down MLB 2015 at midseason. Steve Callis, of course, one of the longstanding FDH Lounge dignitaries and somebody who you can catch on his regular show, his weekly show on the STN.net. Additionally, on WFAN in New York, SNY in New York, many different New York-based large media outlets. And Steve has been on with us to cover many different subjects over a period of time. Probably the one that he is the most associated with the show would be baseball. Although, again, his variety with us has been striking. On the show where nothing is off topic, he has covered more of them than a lot of our dignitaries, to be sure. And today we're taking a look at the Major League Baseball season halfway through, seeing where we go from here the rest of July, August, September, and October. With that having been said, we bring in my good friend, FDH Lounge dignitary Steve Callis. How are you today, my man?
Very well, Rick. Great to be with you as always.
Thanks, buddy. It's great to have you on. As always, these are always great discussions with you. Let's get right into it. As we're coming off of the All-Star break here very recently behind us, we saw, of course, the big media story coming out of the game being the first time that anyone in the history of baseball has ever won the MVP award for the game twice, that being Mike Trout, twice in a row, that is, as he defended his crown there. I have a setup for you here that I apologize for the length of it, but I want to allow you to go in any different direction here because it's such a fascinating topic when you're talking about all-time great players. Of course, just winning that honor twice in a row doesn't mean anything as far as the all-time greats go, because if you look at that list, I think there's some Jeff Conines on that list of All-Star Award, All-Star MVPs, but as far as his place in the game, baseball seems to be the only major sport where we don't really speculate much about somebody being the best player of all time because we put Babe Ruth up there, Ty Cobb, and with the 100-plus year history of the American and National Leagues, it seems ridiculous to be talking in those terms. You don't really tend to hear that much. There might have been a little speculation about Barry Bonds at his height, but you see it in basketball all the time and hockey. Now with Nathan MacKinnon coming in, is he the latest guy that can maybe be better than Gretzky? And you see it in the NFL now with this Tom Brady versus Joe Montana discussion coming off of the last Super Bowl. But I wonder if we're at the point yet where it might not be ridiculous, particularly when you start forecasting the future, to start talking about Mike Trout that way, because he's really separated himself over the last year and a half. It was a real battle between he and Miguel Cabrera, and any time you can be mentioned in the same breath as him right out of the gate, that tells you something. But he has now separated. It's pretty clear he's on a tier of his own, and if you look at the tier that's behind him, even if he weren't there, that's a tier I think that would compare pretty favorably to some of the past times, whether it be Griffey and Bonds, whether it be that generation or some of the previous ones. So what is it about this kid as far as his ability at this point in time at age 23 to be able to take this kind of a step, given the usual growth curves that we have, another 6 years or so probably before he might even start to tail off, in terms of what we're looking at here, I guess take this in whatever direction you want to as far as the greatness of Mike Trout, what he is now, what he can become, and essentially how he's being regarded in the game's history.
Well, I'll start with the greatest player of all time. And look, Mike Trout is the best player today. He is the quintessential five-tool player. We'll talk about his reduction in stolen bases. Personally, I think that's for a reason. But without question, the top player in the game right now. And even Cabrera, Triple Crown winner Cabrera, you'll recall, certainly doesn't have the defensive prowess of a Trout, certainly doesn't have the running ability of a Trout. And when we talk about five-tool players, there are just very few of them. But the bigger, broader scope, and I think the problem in baseball with the greatest player ever, is because of the greatness of Babe Ruth. And whenever you can try and approach him statistically, offensively, as Barry Bonds did, although virtually all of us agree he was well-aided in doing that, and so I would never put Bonds in the class of Ruth. My complaint about Bonds was always he was a Hall of Fame player before he ever took a steroid. And if you look at the Game of Shadows book, the paperback edition, Rick, which came out a little later, it's the most well-researched book of all time. So it's pretty clear that it wasn't until 1998 when Maguire and Sosa had that phony home run race, in my opinion, that Bonds got furious. These guys can't even carry my jockstrap. How are they better than me? And then, poof, go look at the stats from 99 on. He became Superman. But I think the problem in baseball specifically compared to the other major sports is Babe Ruth, because not only was he the greatest offensive player of all time, he was also on his way to being a Hall of Fame pitcher. I mean, he was just stunning. When you go back and look at his Red Sox numbers as a pitcher, he was the best left-hander in the game, 1915, 16, 17, 18, around then, and was actually being, I don't know what the word is, I guess held back from being the incredible offensive player that he became. Although everybody understands in 1920, which was the beginning of the live ball era, that's when his numbers went off the charts. But people forget that in 1919, with the presumably dead ball, he hit 29 homers. That was like 59 homers back then, Rick. So I think the problem is, it's almost like, and I'll skip to one other thing we might talk about, the four greatest Yankees of all time. Clearly, if anyone has a brain, it was going to be Ruth, Gehrig, DiMaggio, and Mantle. And thankfully, the vote was Ruth, Gehrig, DiMaggio, Mantle. And as great as Jeter is or was, as great as Rivera is or was, as great as any other Yankee in the last 40 years you can name, as great or was, I don't know how anyone's ever going to break that big four. So the beauty of Trout is that in today's game, he's the best player. If you took people just on playing baseball position players, you could at least make a case early on. Now, you know, you go look at Joe DiMaggio's first 5 years before he went into the service, which really hurt him, by the way. His first 5 years was stunning. They were better than Mike Trout years, if you can imagine. But Trout as a player today is the best all-around player, period. Arguably the best offensive player. Cabrera gives him certainly a fight. Arguably one of the best defensive players, if not the best defensive player. He's a human highlight film. I mean, you watch SportsCenter every day. He goes over the wall like every other day to steal a home run. It's just stunning how many times he's done it. So I think the big picture, the greatest player of all time, I don't see how there could be a greater player than Babe Ruth, because I don't think you're going to have a guy who can both be the greatest offensive player of all time, and seemed to have a reputation early on, by the way, as a younger player, as a very good defensive player, and of course always had a gun for an arm, in addition to being a great pitcher. I don't think that's ever going to be matched. So I think all baseball players, when you talk about that greatest label, are always going to be second to Ruth. And I would include, by the way, Barry Bonds, as he was, also not being better than a Babe Ruth. So Trout's the best today. He's run by Cabrera. Cabrera's great. But Mike Trout is, to me, far and away the best player in baseball today. And has a good shot, by the way, to win an MVP this year. You know, he's been second twice and first, of course, last year in his first 3 years, Rick. And that's got to be unprecedented in the history of baseball.
It is. And I'll tell you what, let's stay on this for another second, because it's fun to throw names in. And I think for whatever reason in baseball more than the other sports, it's fun to find some of these points of commonality. By the way, I will confess, when we voted for best baseball non-pitcher of all time, so any of the hitters in the FDH Lounge Pantheon balloting, I cast the sole vote for Willie Mays, just because I was taking defense into account as well. So I voted for him over Babe Ruth, actually, although everything you said about Babe Ruth is very well taken. No question about that. But you mentioned the name Mickey Mantle also. I remember being struck when Mike Trout was a rookie, and those were the comparisons being made, because you normally hear somebody from the previous generation. You would more expect to hear, oh, he's like Ken Griffey Jr. in this way. You would expect to hear the more contemporary points of comparison. Mickey Mantle, that's shorthand for on the top tier of best players of all time, and a guy who, again, if he took better care of himself and didn't get injured, could have been the very best of all time. So very, very high praise for Mike Trout in that way. There was another name that was thrown into the mix that I thought was really very interesting. Adam Jones, who himself is a very interesting guy, kind of a clever guy. You might have heard this quote. He was quoted as saying after the All-Star game that he reminded him of a white Bo Jackson. And I thought to myself, I don't quite know about that in one way. And I went to Baseball Reference, and I was correct in my assumption. Bo Jackson definitely had a hole in his swing, not a huge one, but he definitely had one that Mike Trout does not have. So it's really interesting. And even on the surface, you look at, again, that fielder's choice where he made it to first base, though, the fact that the guy has the motor that he does. You look at the crew cut there, and in a lot of ways you think Pete Rose, although I always thought the whole Charlie's Hustle thing had some self-aggrandizement to it as well, that Pete Rose wanted to be known as the greatest hustler of all time, and Mike Trout just hustles, and I don't think really cares if you praise him for it or not. But it's really interesting, the amalgam of styles, the amalgam of skill sets, all these things you can look at in this guy who, again, I have to tell you, you know, for people who are outside the baseball bubble, unfortunately, still isn't really a mainstream figure yet. As incredible as that is, you know, maybe it takes something like this to wake up the general public. I don't know, but you know, when you get talking about Mike Trout, I think the All-Star experience just illuminated this, Steve. There's so many different directions you can go in when you're talking about this guy and his place in history.
Well, I don't think it's a problem for Mike Trout, but I think the problem nationally, as you've spoken about, we live in such a toot-your-own-horn world now. We live in such a world where, you know, every tackle in the NFL is celebrated, whether you're up 35-0 or down 35-0. A guy like Trout who just goes out and does his job and hustles like crazy and does everything. You know, I read a bunch of things about the All-Star game, and, you know, arguably, one of the key plays of the game was Trout busting it down the line to just get ahead of beating a double play, which would have been a double play on 98% of the players in the league. Trout busted down the line in the All-Star game. I understand home field advantage and all that, but most guys wouldn't have. Beats it out, winds up scoring a big run at the time when it was still a game. And for all the other things he did, leadoff home run, et cetera, that to me was maybe the best play to look at as a young ball player or a dad watching a game with his kids. So I think the beauty of Trout, certainly for an old timer like me, I'm happy to say that, Rick, is here's a guy who goes out and just does what he's supposed to do. I recently read that book by Kostya Kennedy on DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak, and they had a whole thing. Much of the book, the theme is DiMaggio just went out and played, just didn't matter, just, you know, killed himself at all times, just that's what he did, and there was never a day. And, you know, at the end of his career, they asked, you know, somebody asked him, so Joe, why do you, you know, you're the best player in the game, why are you doing this, blah, 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 and all he said was, somebody might be watching me for the first time. I think Trout, I don't know if he consciously thinks that, but I think he's just a gamer. He goes out and plays the game. And in my opinion, Rick, that's just not as well respected today as it was a generation ago. You have to watch him play. He's not going to tell you how great he is. And once you have to make that little jump of actually watching and listening and learning and studying, you know, a lot of people just don't do that anymore. But his numbers speak for themselves. And I think that's the missing link. If he was one of these look-at-me guys, he'd have a much higher profile in the United States as a sports superstar. But guess what? This guy is so big, I think over time he's going to get there anyway.
Yeah, no question about it. In spite of the fact that he's not a self-promoter, and again, as you said, very, very refreshing and a throwback to when people talk about the good old days and can point to things that actually were good, that kind of attitude, that kind of self-effacement is certainly high on the list, and he embodies that very well. Before we get to the actual landscape of baseball, you had alluded to it. Let's get to this whole thing with baseball doing the voting for what is essentially the Mount Rushmore for every team, and then the greatest living players. And as you cited, your New York Yankees, your hometown team there, they got it right on the balloting. I sort of held my breath thinking, ah, surely Jeter's going to crash the party, but he didn't. And much to the credit of the people doing the voting, most of the other teams were not so lucky. Listen, I love Jim Thome. I love Omar Vizquel. I love the teams of the 90s. But some real prisoner-of-the-moment stuff on a lot of the other ballots there. How do you do the Cleveland Indians and not have Rocky Colavito on the list? That's my first thought. You know, you go on down, you know, further, and you start thinking of the other names that could be there. whether it be Larry Doby. My favorite player growing up, Andre Thornton. I realize it was a downtime in the history of the team, and somebody's going to suffer for that, but Andre Thornton was the bright light of that period of time, and maybe you should get some credit for that. A lot of stuff with teams where it really seemed like prisoner of the moment as far as the balloting went, but I guess you're going to have that. That's the nature of it.
Well, it is the nature of it. It reminds me of 2000 when ESPN did those greatest athletes of all time, and in 1950 they had done the half-century greatest athletes, not ESPN, of course, but writers at the time, and they voted Jim Thorpe the number one athlete of all time, and he had twice as many votes as Babe Ruth. Flash forward 50 years later, and somehow Thorpe dropped to like 7, which was really a joke. And whatever you think of Michael Jordan, greatest basketball player ever or not, there's no chance that he's the greatest athlete ever. And you know, when I wrote an article back then about it, I had guys like, we're talking athletes here. To me, that's people who are great at many things. So as you know, Michael Jordan couldn't hit a curveball, and I don't care if he picked up baseball from the beginning. That's virtually an impossible. The notion that he was going to be the greatest baseball player ever is an absurdity. Once I heard someone talking about John McEnroe, think of what a great Major League Baseball shortstop he would have been. Well, I don't know if he throws right. I know he hit left, so that's ridiculous. But the notion that these guys can walk into these other sports is absurd to me. So to me, you have a guy like Thorpe or Jackie Robinson or Bo Jackson, frankly. You know, the Bo Jackson-Trout comparisons to me are physical, not baseball playing ability. Trout 6'2", 235. Bo might have been a little bigger and stronger, but they were that kind of really powerful, not 6'6 guy. So there's always a problem with these things. The name that came to me in the Indians, which you alluded to with the 90s, but I'm not saying he should be in the top four, but I think he should have been mentioned, and that was Albert Bell. Albert Bell, who, you know, when you look at his numbers, you can't believe him. I know he was disliked. And I totally agree with you, Rocky Colavito, for better or worse, old enough to have seen Rocky Colavito kill the Yankees on a number of occasions in the 60s. But certainly there are a lot of other names, and that is the problem. And I give you the analogy to 2000 and ESPN Sports Center picking, you know, Jordan and these guys. And somehow, by the way, Ruth flipped over Jim Thorpe when the people who were there at the time not only voted for Thorpe, but again, Thorpe had twice as many votes as anybody, including Babe Ruth. So give that some thought when we're talking the greatest athlete of all time. But yeah, by definition, I think you're just going to get a lot of more recent players. Although I look at, for example, the Dodgers, and I see Don Drysdale, Sandy Koufax, Jackie Robinson, and Duke Snider. So obviously all guys back from the Brooklyn Dodgers into the L.A. Dodgers days. So that's pretty interesting. But, yeah, you could go through this. You could do 6 hours on that list. But generally speaking, Rick, I think when you vote in the present, it's going to be about a lot of players from the present. And I'm thankful, at least in the New York Yankees case. You know, there's a lot more controversy about the Mets, you know, the notion that Keith Hernandez was one of the four greatest Mets of all time, or even David Wright, really? Now, I don't want to make this a New York show, but, you know, they left out guys like Gooden and Strawberry. I know they had their problems, but they were great, great players, and they were great, great players on the Mets for a long time, obviously, before right. They went to other teams. So I don't want to get into that, but I think the general rule is, Rick, when you're voting in 2015, you're going to get a lot of people in the last 20, 25 years because that's who the people saw. They didn't see people from the 20s through the 60s through the 80s, frankly, and that affects some, but not all of the voting.
Absolutely. I think that's what accounts for that, no question about it. You talked about the Yankees. I don't know if we're going to have time to hit division by division, but let's start with that. Let's start with the AL East. Joe Girardi doing clearly one of his finest managing jobs ever with there, a strong candidate for manager of the year, doing it with a lot of spare parts there. You go on down there, I had low expectations for the entire division, and again, they've all been right about 500, aside from the Yankees that at the moment are a little bit above it. And Tampa Bay has got some pretty good hurling. Toronto's got some guys that can bash the baseball between the two of them. If you put them together, they'd be the 98 Yankees. Separately, they're about mediocre 500 teams. Baltimore is right there in the mix. Showalter's doing a pretty good job just to get what he can out of those guys. Boston, I called it that they were – I don't know if I knew that they were going to suck this year, but everybody was way overrating their pitching, and I called that one going in, and I was right. So looking at the East there, a real crop of mediocrity. clearly only going to send one team to the playoffs. Right now, your Yankees are in the driver's seat. I don't know how long they can keep it up, but
again,
good pitching at the top of the rotation. That has really helped them.
Yeah, I don't mind saying the Yankees are surprising me, and I'm a Yankee fan forever. Having said that, it's the old, they're in the right division. And I don't think this is a terrible division. I don't know if I'd say mediocre, but everybody is around 500, as you've said. I guess that's the definition of mediocrity. But everybody's got their problems in that division, and the Yankees have not had the problems of the other teams because who thought Teixeira, a notorious slow starter, you know, would be an all-star and have the power numbers he has? Who really thought A-Rod, look, if you gave me 20, and we might have spoken about this last time, if you gave me 20 as the under-over for A-Rod homers, I would have taken the under, and he's already at 18. Now, can they keep that up for a whole year? You know, everyone's thinking Tanaka's arm's going to fall off the next time he pitches, and that has to happen. And we have talked about Pineda in the past. When he came over from Seattle, I said he was a 2, possibly a 1. And now he's gone through, you know, a couple of years of injury, so-so stuff. But when he's healthy and pitching, you've seen what he is this year. So they've kind of done it with smoke and mirrors, but in my mind they've done it with smoke and mirrors because they're in the correct division, and, you know, don't underestimate that. So, yeah, the problem with Tampa Bay, as you said, pitching, not too much hitting. They said Longoria had a wrist injury earlier in the year and never really took time off, and his numbers are kind of down. And if he's not a big-time hitter, then Tampa has very little offense. Toronto, the exact opposite, as you alluded to. Boston, I'm not surprised that they're down, but they're not out. You know, they're Boston, and again, they're in the right division. And Baltimore, they lost Nick Markakis. They lost Nelson Cruz. Can they still do it? Buck Showalter is a great manager, not a good manager. But, yeah, that division's up for grabs, and I certainly am surprised that the Yankees are still on top. But, of course, rooting for them all the way.
Yeah, well, I don't blame you. And, you know, I of course, have been rooting for my Cleveland Indians as we move to the Central through what has been a disappointing first half. Again, I really kind of cast a jaundiced eye towards the entire American League coming into the season. That's what allowed me to pick the Indians to win the American League, albeit losing the World Series to St. Louis. But I thought to myself, you know, four strong starters at the top of the rotation, if they make the playoffs, they're probably the toughest out. They're not going to score a lot of runs, but who's going to score on these guys? The Indians becoming the first team in the history of baseball. They have four guys over 100 strikeouts by the All-Star break, and yet they sat at the All-Star break with a record of 42-46 because the offense has been inconsistent would be a nice word. Terrible has been the word, I think, for most of the time. Meanwhile, in that division, you've got Chicago kind of bringing up the rear. Again, looking like their gamble the last couple of years in going top-heavy with a couple of star players really is not apparently working out because they don't have the kind of depth from their farm system that they need. Detroit, I called this one coming in, that the sun might have set on them. They're not what they were a couple of years ago. Detroit is still in it, but not looking like what they were. Minnesota, really kind of a fluky first half, if you look at the advanced statistics and the way that they've been able to get it done. But, again, the young talent that they continue adding from the farm system, and it's only going to make them stronger. And Kansas City, I'll be the first to admit it, I didn't see that coming, that they were going to carry over as strongly as they were from last year. Honestly, that run they had last fall reminded me a lot of what Colorado did in 2007, and none of that carried over the next year. But for Kansas City, it really has, even with letting go of James Shields and their rotation essentially being, you know, fairly questionable for a team with such a great record. But somehow or another, they've gotten it done. Ned Yost maybe even doing a better managing job with them this year. So how do you see the Central shaking out?
Well, I think Kansas City's obviously for real. As you said, they were able to carry over, unlike Colorado. They were obviously able to carry it over to this year. A couple of interesting things for me, though. Another, you know, whatever you think of wild cards in general, two wild cards in particular, a team like Cleveland, you know, Corey Kluber, who everybody's watching this year, 4-10. But he's third in the league in strikeouts. I mean, he's pitching some terrible luck. I think he gets the least run support in Major League Baseball. So I don't think they're that far away. And as you look at the standings during the All-Star break, they're only 5.5 games out of a wild card. No, 5.5 games is a lot, and they got to jump a lot of teams. But the point is, whichever of these teams gets hot is going to make a run. I don't think it's going to be Detroit. Cabrera's still out for another month. I've watched Justin Verlander pitch a lot, and he's been, you know, I always kill CC Sabathia, who, again, And you love the guy with what he did years ago, pitching for Milwaukee, you know, for a month on 3 days rest. That was unbelievable. Certainly a workhorse for the Yankees, including 2009, you know, winning the whole thing. But now he's a four or a five. I think Justin Verlander is a four or a five and has been like that now for a few years, Rick. So I think Detroit's in trouble. I don't know that Minnesota can keep it up. Kansas City looks more legitimate. So I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility for a Cleveland to make a run in the second half. I wouldn't walk away from that prediction quickly because it's kind of like the NFL, which I call the MFL, the Mediocre Football League. The way the teams, the way the leagues, the management, the upper management, the commissioners, what they want is parity. So they want everybody around 500, and you know why, because then every game will be important and everybody has a chance for the playoffs. I mean, they're talking about adding more playoff teams in the NFL. What a joke. But what they want is for you to be involved in August and September in baseball, for you to be involved with a chance maybe to get that last wild card spot in late November through December in the NFL. And that's what they want. Same in hockey and basketball, which forever has had, you know, a ton of teams in the playoffs, more than half the league in both of those sports. So that's where we are. That's a business decision. So I look at the Central and I say, yeah, Cleveland can still make a run, although I think Kansas City's for real and is either going to win it all or you know, be a wild card.
You know what? And that's a great point. You talk about the wild card, where the Indians are this year versus where they were in 2013 shows you exactly what you need as far as advancing in October. Because in 2013, that 10-game winning streak put them in that game. They had to go with young Danny Salazar in that spot, who just wasn't quite ready for it yet. This year, you know what? If you got to pitch Kluber in the wild card game, who cares? Because you got Carrasco behind him, you got Bauer, you got Salazar. Nobody in the American League can match up with that, albeit the hitting's been bad. And again, as I've covered a number of different times on this show, I often get called, if anything, a pessimist. I am not an Indians homer when it comes to the predictions. I am not somebody who's pro Dolan family. So when I pick them to win, it's in spite of my inherent, I will say, pessimism. No question about that. In the West, some real surprises there. One of the bigger ones being that the hipster favorite of this year, I would say, the Seattle Mariners, really not getting the job done to this point. Robinson Cano really starting to look his age, if not older, is certainly having a lot to do with that. Oakland in last place, you kind of saw that coming because Billy Beane, for whatever reason, did a teardown after last season. The Angels are up in first place where you'd expect them right now. Texas right in the middle. Kind of thought they'd fall apart more than they did after Yu Darvish went down, but they've been resilient. The big story, though, as far as a surprise, Houston being this good this soon. We knew in a couple of years they were really, really, really going to be dangerous. And again, they've been fading after that big start. And they're not even a lock to make the playoffs at this point. But what Houston has done right now, one of the biggest stories in all of baseball, I think, not just the American League, Steve.
Well, no question. I mean, Houston, I think we talked about before the season started, I thought they needed another year, and that may turn out to be true, but they're 2-8 last 10 going into the All-Star break. That's a problem. The Angels have overtaken what looked like a gigantic lead, you know, 6 weeks ago. I think they were up 6 or 7 games. The Angels are the Angels are the Angels, and don't forget Albert Pujols having a great year as well as Mike Trout. Texas, not surprising. I'm surprised about the Mariners. I really like them. You know, I was looking at Cano's numbers because I got to tell you, I watched him so much and have said numerous times 4, 5, 6 years ago, this guy could be one of the greatest second basemen of all time. His numbers are unbelievable, and I'll just give you a few. His last 4 years as a Yankee, he averaged 29 homers, 107 RBIs, and hit .312. So when he went to Seattle, Rick, you knew his power numbers would go down. But he went 14, 82 RBIs, hit .314 with a .382 OBP. So to me, it was like, well, he made the switch. He's making a lot of money. He got his lifetime contract. Good for him. But this year at the All-Star break, 6 home runs, 30 RBIs, hitting .251. His OBP is .290. That's like 15 points under his lifetime batting average. So he really has fallen off a cliff. Maybe you're right. It's just age. I don't know if your listeners are like this. I don't know if that's really his age. You just don't know, frankly. You know, supposedly he was born in 1982, which would only make him 32. If anything, maybe he's leaving the absolute prime of his career. But you would expect that he would have 3 more years of incredible production, and he's just fallen off a cliff. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. So that was a huge blow to Seattle's chances. But I think the Angels are going to separate themselves. I don't think Houston's going to hold on, although clearly, you know, if you asked me after 60 games or 70 before this last 2-8 swoon, I would have to say, well, they look for real. I mean, Keuchel's a legitimate Cy Young candidate. But I think the Angels are going to win that division. I don't know if you're going to get a wild card out of that. It might all come from the Central. You know, if Cleveland makes a run or Detroit becomes better than I thought or Minnesota hangs on, in addition to Kansas City, I have a feeling that's where the wild card's going to come out of the Central, out of the American League.
Right. I would tend to agree with that.
And maybe
as well.
maybe two wild cards, frankly, because that's how much better I think that division is potentially because of the surprise, frankly, of Minnesota. And I won't say the surprise of Kansas City, but the surprise that they're 52-34 at the All-Star break.
Well, exactly. Nobody saw that coming. They've got a record that stands up, I'd say, toe-to-toe with the superpowers of the National League. And, again, let's take a look at that more as a whole. Let's start with the top-level teams, the ones that we expected to all be up there at the top in their divisions, Washington, the L.A. Dodgers, St. Louis. Maybe a lot of people didn't regard St. Louis that way. I did coming into this year, and I've been justified in that. Even with Adam Wainwright going down again, because even if their offense has a few holes in it here and there, they've still been really, really dominant. You've got them in the mix for the wild card. You've got the Cubs, who I did expect to at least be at the periphery of it in the first year with Joe Maddon and with investing and upgrading that team, and Jake Arrieta becoming a legitimate ace. I mean, I think he became one last year, but he's really proved it. And then on the periphery of the mix as well there, well, closer to the middle of the mix, I guess, would be Pittsburgh, which has done their usual surge. San Francisco, which has belied their usual performance in recent odd-numbered years. And the New York Mets, who they may be one-dimensional in terms of just having pitching, but that one dimension is pretty doggone good, as we saw at the All-Star break with Jacob deGrom, last year's National League Cy Young Award winner, really getting it done. So those appear to be the main teams at the both the periphery and then more towards the mainstream of what you'd call the playoff race there. Six teams and ultimately five spots. So of those ones, or I'm sorry, seven teams if we're going to put the Cubs in there. So two of these teams will not make it. It looks like the other five will come from there. It's certainly a more powerful crop, I think, all in all, when we're looking at that, than with the American League, which is exactly what I expected coming into the season.
Yeah, well, as I look at the National League, certainly I pick Washington to win the whole thing. No shock there, you know, with their pitching and Scherzer, who doesn't have the greatest record on earth but might be the best pitcher in baseball, has just been unbelievable with some stunning individual performances and back-to-back one-hit. I mean, it's just when you watch him pitch, he really knows how to pitch. And, oh, by the way, you know, he throws in the mid to high 90s. If I have to remove a team from the seven, and I said the Mets would contend for a wild card and think they still can, but there is such criticism in New York. You know, David Wright now went from sliding into second and hurting his groin to spinal stenosis, and nobody even thinks he's coming back this year. Sandy Alderson, you know, they wrote a book. They came out with a book, How He Revolutionized Baseball and Brought the Mets Back. Are the Mets back? Are they back, Rick? I mean, they're five games over 500. I don't know if they've been over 500 in the All-Star break in the last 5 years or so. So I don't know that they're back. Do they have the best young pitching staff in baseball? Absolutely. I mean, they trot out guys who are unbelievable. But as they put, when Steven Matz somehow hurt an abdominal muscle after pitching two unbelievable games and being a great young hitter as well as a pitcher, you know, in the papers all it says was, well, he's on the Mets. He's going to be gone for a month. You know, and that seems to be, I don't know if they're snake bitten, but when their guys get hurt, David Wright, another example, and they really can't hit. And I remember we talked about it last year, and I wrote an article about it, and I said, don't trade Bartolo Colon and don't trade David Murphy. And the only argument for David Murphy was, yeah, he's not great in the field, 188 hits. And if you have 188 hits in the Major League Baseball season and you're on the Mets, you're the best hitter on the Mets. And that's, of course, proven. He was hurt earlier. That, of course, has been proven to be true. Colon, I didn't expect he was going to be a Cy Young candidate like he pitched early on. But what I did and do expect is, here's a guy, if they're in a playoff race late in the year. Here's a guy who's been through it all, who's 41, who's an innings eater, who is pitching well. I said at the beginning, if the guy goes 14-11 and throws over 200 innings, you've hit the jackpot, and they couldn't give him away last year. They were trying to. So I don't know where the Sandy Alderson magic is. The pitching staff does remind me, old me, of the 68-69 Mets pitching staff. I think they're comparable. I don't know if you have a Seaver, but between Harvey and DeGrom, you have two top pitchers. I don't know if Harvey is coming back as Steven Strasburg. You know, Strasburg was unbelievably dominant, had Tommy John. Now he's a very good pitcher who gets hurt. Now, Harvey was dominant early on, but now he's a very good pitcher who gives up home runs. So I see the analogy between the Mets of 69 pitching staff and the Mets of today. What I don't see is them picking up a Don Clendenin at the trade deadline. What I don't see is them having a Cleon Jones who hit 341 and led the National League hitting in 69. That's what I don't see for the Mets. So I'm afraid they're going to, now they were 7-3 last 10 before the break, and they've closed the gap back to within two of Washington, but I think Washington is too deep. The other team I think to talk about just briefly in the East is Miami. They've been really, really disappointing. And I'm hoping they're going to move Ichiro, who I consider one of the best 50 players of all time. When they were, you know, Ichiro now reminds me of Ichiro in Seattle when the Yankees got him. He hit 322 the rest of the year, I think, because Seattle wasn't going anywhere, and then they put him in a pennant race, not necessarily the Yankees. Now here too, Miami, Ichiro was doing well early on, and then he fell off a cliff. He's hitting like 260 now, but I think he should be traded to a contender. I wrote an article that the Mets should have gotten him, and I'll tell you, his 260, 270, 280 in the Mets lineup would look like 300 the way they're hitting. Quickly in the Central, St. Louis. I thought they'd be okay without Wainwright. I didn't think they'd have the best record in baseball by far, 56-33. Here's another division where you might get two wild cards out of there. Pittsburgh has played really well. They're in the wrong division from a record perspective. They're playing 600 baseball. They're only 2.5 behind St. Louis. The Cubs, I think Madden's the best manager in baseball by far, followed him closely at Tampa Bay. As you know, my son's a Tampa Bay Rays fan because Tino Martinez played there 1 year after the Yankees traded him. To this day, he still roots for him. So we follow Madden, although he still roots for Tampa Bay. But I think the Cubs are a factor. I wouldn't know who to eliminate out of Pittsburgh, Chicago, and maybe San Francisco. I just don't know. I'd probably eliminate San Francisco, gun to my head, but that's only because I want the Cubs to make it. I'd like the Cubs to win a World Series in my lifetime, Rick, and I'm not even a Chicago Cubs fan, but when you start here in 1908, as you know, even 1945 for the World Series, I mean, those are some mind-boggling statistics that the Red Sox have managed to defeat in the last decade. I'll give them credit for that. But, yeah, I think St. Louis is the class of the National League, even without Wainwright, as amazing as that is. But I think Pittsburgh's a playoff team for sure, and the Dodgers. And we'll see. I think it's going to be between San Francisco and the Cubs for that final wild card spot.
I agree. And sentimentally, I would agree with you with the Cubs over San Francisco. But my head says, even though it's an odd-numbered year, again, I can't go against San Francisco when the chips are down based on what they've done the last couple of years. Before we move beyond the really good teams, I certainly want to note also that one of the huge stories in the game this year has been the influx of explosive young talent. Chris Bryant for the Cubs and Jock Peterson for the Dodgers in an epic duel for National League Rookie of the Year. Jock Peterson, I want to mention on a really self-serving note, bearing fruit for my long-term keeper league that I'm in. Picked him up when he was in A-ball 2 or 3 years ago, so that's panning out nicely. But, he's been a nice replacement for Matt Kemp there, which as we segue to some of the disappointments, you touched on Miami. They're certainly among them. And, again, I was joking about with the American League, all the hipsters taking Seattle. Well, I have to sheepishly put my hand in the air and say I picked the National League wild card game to be San Diego and Miami. And, again, they rank as two of the bigger egg layers thus far, proving yet again, I didn't listen to it, but the teams that win November tend not to win the next season. And they have both really just kind of fallen apart here. For San Diego, I know injuries have played a part in that. Will Myers going down just as he was finally getting healthy again certainly doesn't help. But those are big disappointments. And Cincinnati, the team hosting the All-Star game this year, when we're looking at a scenario where they're going to let Johnny Cueto probably walk away at the end of the year, or actually rather than that, trade him now. Johnny Cueto is a guy you build around if you're lucky enough to have him. You try to sign him, and again, maybe they've really made a good effort at it, but Cincinnati's just throwing in the towel on the future as well. So those three teams there, it's kind of a head-scratcher. They're as bad as they are.
Yeah, of the three, I thought the Padres would be real good. And, you know, Matt Kemp, James Shields, Will Myers, Craig Kimbrell, Justin Upton.
Yep.
I mean, my goodness.
What's
but
I
will say Myers, who I watched all the time at Tampa Bay. Again, they're in the AL East, and my son loves them. When healthy, looked like he was going to be really, really good. They wanted him to be the number two to Longoria, and I don't even think he could carry that weight. So I don't know if it's just I'm injured all the time. I'm not ready for the big, big stage in terms of being a superstar. Kemp only hitting 242 with six homers. You know, who knew? Showed flashes last year. The Dodgers were a four outfielder team with, you know, only three outfield positions. I thought Shields could really help the whole staff, you know, kind of like a Bartolo Colon, arguably better. But yeah, they all fell off a cliff. I don't think it was Bud Black's fault. I guess they decided, you know, to blame the manager, and, you know, they brought in the GM, and of course that's just gone further backwards. I'm just totally disappointed in the Padres, but also the Marlins, you know, a lot of young talent. I don't think anyone thought anybody was going to beat Washington for the East. I understand the Mets are only two games out. Miami's done already, 11 games out, you know, 10 out of the wild card. But it's what you said. Nobody who wins November, or rarely does someone win November, December, and then win it the next year. Maybe the Yankees over the winter of 2008, 2009 when they signed, you know, all those guys. Maybe that's one example. But even that nowadays with people taking up their signing their young players, you know, Trout signed through 2020. Stanton got the big contract. And, of course, not that they were doing great with Stanton, but all hope ended when Stanton got hurt. And I'll something to follow. Now, when you hurt your wrist, Rick, I really think this is something that, you know, this might be a great article. Coming back from a wrist injury, and I'll use Teixeira as an example. Coming back from a wrist injury last year, he was not very good. But this year, he's been unbelievable, including an explosive start. He had a wrist injury. Longoria, they said this year early on, he hurt his wrist, hasn't had time to rest it. I'm afraid when Stanton comes back, if it's 4 to 6 weeks, and most people I know about wrist injuries say it's going to be longer than that, so we'll have to keep an eye on that. But he may not be able to just turn it around right away, and it might go into next year. I think for some reason, these wrist injuries really are really tough to come back from. You can come back from them, but they seem to take an incredibly long time. As far as Cincinnati, I really didn't expect a whole lot from them, but trading Johnny Cueto, you're 100% right. I mean, what are you doing? What are you doing to the fan base if you trade this guy? Because if you trade this guy, you have to somehow replace him with a pitcher, and they're not going to be able to replace Johnny Cueto. He's one of maybe the 10 pitchers in the league you can't replace. I think he's a top pitcher, and I think they'd be foolish to trade him.
I think so as well. Just to wrap up, to touch a little bit on two notes that you had talked about there. Yeah, when you talk about guys getting locked up by their teams like Trout and Stanton, this is what I've been saying about teams like the Yankees for a while now, is that in this day and age, unless you have a farm system, and the Yankees are slowly rebuilding theirs and you're slowly starting to see the fruits of it in the last year or so, you really are going to have to deal with smoke and mirrors. One of the reasons that my Indians have had to deal with smoke and mirrors so bad is that their drafting has just been so god-awful for the last 15 years. So you have to have that. You have to have the guys to lock up because other teams are locking up their guys, and the free agency market ain't what it used to be, and probably that's not going to change anytime soon. Last note also, too, you talked about Sandy Alderson. That triggered a memory of mine because I've always long regarded him as being one of the top executives, but a real skid mark on the shorts of his record that nobody talks much about. That's the guy that let Bruce Bochy go because he thought that San Diego should go in a younger direction at manager. Whoops! So, you know, when you talk about something like that, that should follow you around for a long, long, long time. Not that anybody should have a scarlet A on their chest for one thing, but how do you blow something like that?
Yeah, I'll just say this, and I certainly won't defend Sandy Alderson, but in the world of sabermetrics that we live in, and I think it's a very important part of it, I don't think it's everything, but it's a very important part of it, in his world, the manager is just kind of the go-between. You know, that's just the way he views it. The whole Art Howe thing, for example, he just views, and these guys just view the manager as kind of a go-between. I think oftentimes the Sandy Aldersons of the world think they're the managers. They're certainly the formers of the team. They formulate the team and who's on it. And I think they really do believe that the manager isn't that important. Of course, if you believe all that stuff, there's no such thing as a closer. There's no such thing
right.
as a clutch hitter. So you can say Bill James changed the world, and he did. But you'll never convince me, New York guy, after
right.
watching Wetland, Mariano and Wetland in 96, and then whoever else in Mariano through all those other championship years right till the last few years,
yep.
you'll never convince me there's no such thing as a closer. So
absolutely.
I differ
great
with those guys.
Great points as always, my friend. We're about to get cut off here. Great points as always. Thank you so much. Look forward to catching up with you again to cover more MLB. Thank you all, everybody, for tuning in to this mini episode of the FBH Live.